On To the Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Donald Trump is probably the most significant thing to happen to the religious right in a few decades.
OMG, this guy is actually a bigot.
If she becomes president, no one since Richard Nixon would have been on the national stage that long and won the White House.
I'm Warren Olney. To the Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To the Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
We're rehearsing because we are opening the show, and last year Bianca Del Rio opened, and she is so funny, and we're us, so we have our work cut out for us. We're, the only way I can get to rehearse with Katya is if I come meet her somewhere she can smoke.
Yep, so. I'm the Laura Ingalls Wilder drag. Who smokes?
The girl's gone Laura Ingalls Wilder. That's our new web series. It's just a woman stripping off a prairie dress.
No, a woman putting on a prairie dress and living her life.
Trixie Mattel and Katya of RuPaul's Drag Race. We find out tonight who will be crowned the next drag superstar. It's one of many TV finales this week, but there are lots of new shows to look forward to. Coming up, we'll talk about the network upfronts, summer comedies, and fall reboots. But first, the Supreme Court today issued a non-decision in a case about contraception, the Affordable Care Act, and religious freedom. At issue was whether Obamacare's mandate to provide free birth control is a substantial burden on religious groups. The justices asked the two sides to work out a compromise in the lower courts. All eight justices were unanimous in their indecision. An evenly divided court is becoming an issue. As the court winds down this term, Congress has yet to hold a hearing on the nomination of Merrick Garland to fill the ninth seat. So joining me now to discuss all this is Lisa McElroy, Associate Law Professor at Drexel University in Philadelphia. Welcome.
Thank you, Madeline. Hi.
Hi. Well, first, this case, let's talk about that. It's known as the Little Sisters case, referring to an order of nuns in Baltimore. It was supposed to be a major case, seems to be fizzled now. What was in the opinion today?
Yeah, well, the better question might be, what wasn't in the opinion? And what wasn't in the opinion was any real decision about the merits of this case. In fact, Justice Sotomayor, who concurred in this opinion from the court, said, hey, be really, really careful not to read this as our deciding anything at all. So essentially what the Supreme Court did today with only eight justices was tell the lower courts of appeals, hey, you guys, we need you to try to work this out. And of course, people are speculating that maybe this is because with only eight justices, they couldn't themselves find a way to work it out.
But this is a combination of a bunch of cases. So could each lower court then work it out differently?
Well, that's always a problem. And this is a reason why the Supreme Court exists in the first place. We want federal law to be consistent across the country. And what we're dealing with here is this Religious Freedom Restoration Act, what we call RFRA, and how the different areas of the country and their courts are interpreting that law. So yes, right now we do have different opinions in different parts of the country, and that could continue. That gets it back up to the Supreme Court.
So does that mean a woman who works in one part of the country might have different access than a woman who works in another part of the country to contraception?
That's exactly what it means.
Okay.
And so that's why the Supreme Court often steps in these kinds of statutory issues, because they don't want that to be the case. We want it to be that if you live in Baltimore or you live in Los Angeles, you have the same access, the same rights under the Constitution and under federal law. And that's why when the Supreme Court can't decide something, we sometimes enter into muddy waters. And we've been seeing more and more of that since the death of Justice Scalia.
So do you think the court would have handled this a lot differently had there been nine justices seated?
Well, I guess it depends on who those nine justices would be. But of course, there's nothing in the Constitution that says we have to have nine justices. We just have it because it's practical to do it that way. You don't end up with even splits, at least most of the time. Certainly, Justice Scalia was someone who had very strong views on religion and religious freedom. And so it was largely felt that this case would split 5-4. But then Justice Scalia died, and suddenly you're left with a possible 4-4 split. The thing about the justices is they're very secretive. They go into this little conference room they have. I call it their bat cave. And they decide stuff all by themselves, and they don't tell anybody exactly what's going on. So even though we speculate that maybe they just couldn't resolve this, that they were 4-4, we really don't have any way of knowing for sure. And we don't have any way of knowing what's going to happen when there is another justice eventually in that seat.
So meanwhile, just regarding religious liberty, there's this legal memo the Obama administration has left in place, and it's a holdover from the Bush White House that essentially gives religious organizations exemptions when they win federal contracts. In other words, let's say they won a federal contract to take care of victims of human trafficking. They wouldn't necessarily have to provide them with contraception. Does that memo undermine the government's position in this Little Sisters case?
Well, certainly they're theoretically all connected, and this memo has been a point of contention for quite a while. All kinds of groups have been calling on the Obama administration to rescind this memo for exactly the reason you say, that we want there to be true religious freedom and true access for people to things that they have a right to. They're not directly connected, but certainly the administration wants to be consistent in this area. And the administration has been very, very adamant that contraception, for example, is part of a greater healthcare plan. So to the extent that the memo allows religious groups not to provide contraception, not to provide abortion services, or anything else that their religions believe, yeah, that can be a big problem.
So looking at Obamacare, I imagine there are more challenges to it working their way through the courts.
Absolutely. And, you know, the Congress is always trying to say, hey, can we get rid of this? If Congress can't get rid of it, then they're trying to find ways to have legal challenges to it. This one was 7 different cases, plus another 6 or so that were still percolating that the Supreme Court hadn't agreed to hear yet. And certainly religious freedom seems to be a means of attack, especially after some other ways of challenging it. For example, we saw several years ago trying to challenge it under the Commerce Clause, for example. That didn't work so well. So now they're looking for some other avenues, and religion is the winner of the day.
And I wonder, is the court sending a message to Congress by doing this, by kicking it down to the lower court, saying, you know, we can't really function with an evenly split court or 8 justices. We need a 9th. Can you get your act together?
You know, I don't think the court would ever say that in a million years. I think it's extremely logical. I think we all agree that that's the case. But the court wants us to think that everything is just dandy over there at 1 First Street, that they're having no problems and that they can function perfectly well. And I think that if indeed they did split 4-4, which is a pretty darn good guess, the reason they didn't say that is because they don't want to give people the impression that, boy, we can't get anything done here right now.
But I wonder if they're looking at the next term and trimming their sails a bit.
Yeah, well, one problem that they're having right now is that in order to get a case granted review, in order for the Supreme Court to hear a case, 4 justices have to agree that this is a case worth hearing. And if you think about it, if you've got 9 justices, it's probably easier to get 4 to say, yeah, let's hear this, than if you only have 8 justices. And again, we don't know exactly what their conversations look like, but what we do know statistically is that the Supreme Court has granted fewer cases for next term. In other words, in May, we would typically have expected to see a lot more cases that are scheduled for argument next year than we currently do.
And meanwhile, Merrick Garland, he's in purgatory somewhere?
Yeah, I feel so bad for this guy, don't you? Like, he doesn't know whether he should pick up his suit at the dry cleaners or not. You know, is he going to meet with a senator tomorrow? Who knows? Probably not, you know? And certainly journalists have commented on the fact that there's no story there is an incredible story. You know, the fact that we have got this empty seat and we have a nominee and nothing is happening, it's wild. This is the first time in history. And poor Merrick Garland, it's got to be a tough place to be in. From what I hear, he's a super cool, super mellow guy, and I hope this isn't rocking his boat too much.
All right. Well, thanks so much.
Thank you, Madeline.
That's Lisa McElroy, Associate Professor of Law at Drexel University. And we want to hear from you. Should Congress move forward on the Garland nomination? Make him get his dry cleaning done or wait for the next president. Let us know at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY or on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. Well, here in California, affordable housing is becoming a big public policy issue. Governor Jerry Brown is now stepping in. In his new budget, the governor has proposed streamlining the permitting process for housing developments that include affordable units. The governor also supports a measure that would take some funds earmarked for mental health to build housing. California ranks near the bottom of the country when it comes to housing affordability, and LA, one of the least affordable cities in the nation. It also has the country's largest homeless population. But will these state-level efforts make a difference? Joining me now is Robert Kleinhens, economist and executive director at Beacon Economics. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Madeline.
So what is the government proposing when it comes to streamlining this permitting process? How would that work?
Well, not a lot of details are available, but the idea, I think, is to make more administrative or procedural the approval of housing developments that have at least the 20% number of units set aside for low-income residents or near transit to have at least 10%. So one would think that means to, you know, the idea is to get these projects or developments to get through the approval process, which has tended to be very lengthy, not just here in Southern California, but throughout the state.
Like, how long does it take on average to get a project approved?
Well, I mean, it can take years. I'm not sure what the average is, but it can take as many as several years to get a bigger project approved. So much of this really hinges on how things go through the whole deliberation process, which in part depends on CEQA.
Okay, that's the environmental law.
The California Environmental Quality Act, yes.
Right, right. And so, but doesn't this permitting issue and zoning, doesn't that all happen on the local level?
Yeah, so I think what we're going to find is that this idea that Governor Brown has proposed very well could bump into the whole local permitting process, because CEQA allows local communities to go through a number of steps to deliberate on and make a final decision on whether or not to allow a new housing development to go forward. So I do think that this does set us up for some conflict at the, between the state and local jurisdictions.
Right. And so is it possible for the states, the state and the governor to just bigfoot the local leaders and say, nope, this is the way it's going to be?
I'm not so sure about that. I'm not so much a political animal as I am an economist. I think I would just mention that this is a step in the right direction. We've had high housing costs for a long time in California. You know, oftentimes one can say that we pay twice the price for half the house. And even with respect to rental housing, that's a problem. And by the way, we happen to be focusing here on affordable housing, but it's really not just an affordable housing problem that we have in California, but a housing affordability problem, in the sense that even middle-income households have to pay a lot of their income to buy a home here in California compared to the nation as a whole.
So is that hurting the state's economy?
Well, arguably, one of the big challenges that businesses have, especially when they want to attract people from other parts of the country to work here, is that, you know, they have to somehow deal with the high cost of housing. So it's certainly been stated as a challenge for employers. And when you take a look at some of the trends in migration and so on, you actually find that we see more higher income, better educated households moving into California, and lower income, less educated households leaving on net.
Because they can't afford to live here.
Presumably so.
Right. So from an economic point of view, from a business point of view, what are the best incentives to get developers to build affordable housing?
Well, I do think that this is a step in the right direction, because, you know, land in California, especially in the coastal areas, is expensive. You can't do a whole lot about that. We have a variety of regulations, environmental and building code regulations, that are not necessarily going to change, but from what I've heard talking with builders and developers, if the process can be streamlined to move through those decision points more quickly, that would perhaps enable them to hang tough. I mean, you really have to have deep pockets and be willing to put up with a fairly lengthy process, especially if you're looking at a large project, large development. in a major city or even a smaller city here in Southern California. A lot of time. Permitting fees are about three times here in California, about three times higher than they are nationally. So reducing the amount of time it takes to go through the permitting process would help. And of course, permitting fees, to the extent that they can be reduced, certainly wouldn't hurt.
So it's interesting. It's less about tax incentives, from what you're telling me, than just about the bureaucratic bottleneck.
Well, yeah, I mean, the tax incentives, if I understand your question correctly, a lot of those are pointed toward the demand for housing, you know, and I get the impression, given the austerity that Governor Brown would like to have when it comes to the state's budget, I get the impression that he doesn't want to spend more of the state's precious resources on making housing more affordable necessarily. What he'd rather do is allow the private sector to increase its supply and to figure out ingenious ways to enable that to occur without burdening the state government.
And then through supply and demand, that would lower the price of housing.
Right. But
you
I mean,
had more supply. Have to,
exactly. But I, you know, this is a longstanding problem dating back decades. It does require perhaps addressing issues of CEQA. And Prop 13, actually, the way it's structured limits the amount of property tax revenues to go to local government, thereby giving local government an incentive to favor things like retail over housing. There are many other dimensions to this mm-hmm. situation, and it's been around a long time. I view this as a step in the right direction. That is to say, because it's saying, you know, we need to address this problem. And, you know, if we look at the current setup, there may be a couple of things that we can tweak and maybe make this happen more efficiently.
Robert Kleinhans, economist and executive director at Beacon Economics. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Madeline.
And we'd like to hear from you. If you're looking for an affordable place to live in Los Angeles, how is your search going? Give us a call at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can weigh in on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. Coming up, we go to the television upfronts in New York City to get a look at what's coming in the shows that are saying goodbye, some for now, some forever. Our TV segment is next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. Support the podcast you enjoy by donating at kcrw.com/join. And thanks.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. It's goodbye for now to many of our favorite TV shows. RuPaul's Drag Race, Bates Motel, and Jane the Virgin have their season finales tonight. It's goodbye for good tonight for CBS's Mike and Molly and ABC's Castle. But there are plenty of good shows to look forward to, including some great comedies this summer. We're going to preview some of those. And the networks are announcing their fall schedules this week in New York. Michael Schneider is there, and he joins us now. He's host of KCRW's The Spinoff and now the executive editor at IndieWire. Welcome back, and congratulations on your new job.
Thank you so much. Good to be back.
Great to have you. Well, so this is one of the biggest weeks of the year for the networks. And let's talk about the brand new series presented this week in New York. And let's begin with NBC Today.
Yeah, you're right. This is the time of year where we find out what shows die, what shows are new. So NBC, they're praying at the altar of Dick Wolf, for starters. They're adding another show in his Chicago franchise. You know, they already have Chicago Fire, Chicago Med, Chicago PD. Now they're bringing a legal version of his Chicago shows to the air with Chicago Justice. So Dick Wolf, a big deal for them. Otherwise, a couple new comedies that look interesting. And, you know, they're looking to reinvent themselves, as all networks are this time of year.
Reinventing by going with Dick Wolf, Mr. Law & Order?
Well, I guess going back to the future to some degree. The networks a couple of years ago, they tried to play a streaming game, a cable game, where they went with a little more unconventional fare. That stuff didn't work, so you're seeing this year they're going back to meat and potatoes. They're going back to what works. So a lot of it is intellectual properties that you've heard of before. So There's a lot of remakes, a lot of movie remakes, especially at all the networks. Fox, for example, is doing a new version of The Exorcist. They're doing a new version of Lethal Weapon. The CW has a new version of the movie Frequency. NBC's doing a fresh take on the movie Taken. So familiar IP, as they call it, all over the map this year.
Not only that, old game shows being revived, including Match Game with Alec Baldwin.
Yeah, well, that's a big summer play at ABC, where they've had big success with Celebrity Family Feud. So now they're doubling down with all sorts of game shows. They're remaking Pyramid, and of course now Match Game, which we all remember for its cheeky double entendres and B-list celebrities back in the 70s and 80s. They're bringing it back with a new kind of party version with Alec Baldwin hosting. So that could be pretty interesting.
Yeah, and then there's a variety show starring Martin Short and Maya Rudolph.
Yeah, so Maya and Martin, if you watch the Saturday Night Live 40th anniversary special last year, the two of them together did a bit, and there was a lot of chemistry, and I think people started thinking at that moment, why don't we put those two together in a variety show? Everyone's been trying to redo the variety show for years. Maya Rudolph actually tried her own version a couple years ago on NBC, so now they're doing another version. Lorne Michaels is producing, and they're hoping to recreate the magic of those two and sort of the give and take that they had on that SNL special.
And that's called Maya and Marty.
Maya and Marty, and it's going to be on May 31st. So it's a one-off. We'll see how it does. But obviously, if it does well, then we probably should expect more.
Okay. So the shows that are Nevermore, some of them are getting, there's a lot of protest about them. Castle, for example, Nashville, any chance that they might come back in some other iteration?
It's unlikely. The thing with both of those shows is that they've been around for a couple of years, and as shows get older, they also get more expensive. So that's why, in the case of Castle, there was talk of bringing it back, but without one of the stars, Donna Caddick. So it was just going to be Nathan Fillion in order to preserve some costs. But I think ultimately they decided maybe it was just time to let it go. And with Nashville, there's a new administration at ABC. They're rethinking a lot of things. Nashville has been on the air for 4 years now, so it's a little more expensive. The ratings just weren't there, so they decided to call it a day as well.
So with this new administration, Ben Sherwood running it, what is the new philosophy for ABC?
The new philosophy is going a little broader, adding more procedurals, sort of trying to expand things out a little bit. So it's not just serialized shows that are harder for people to get into if they haven't watched them all. But on the flip side, they're also, again, doubling down on Shonda Rhimes. And Shonda Rhimes they trust over at ABC. So not only do they renew her show, The Catch, but she's got another new show that's sort of based on the Romeo and Juliet story, but sort of a sequel to Romeo and Juliet to some degree. So there's a lot of Shonda in ABC's future, as there has been for a while.
And what about Fox? It has Empire. Anything else?
Empire obviously coming back, so that's huge on them. So Fox is big on event series. So again, talking about pre-existing IP, they're bringing back Prison Break, which was a popular show in the 2000s. So they're revisiting that. They also have a new version of 24, this one called 24 Legacy. So no more Jack Bauer, but it's a new generation of 24. They have a new show from Lee Daniels, the mastermind behind Empire. He's got another musical show called Star coming on. And then there's a couple of new comedies, including an unconventional one. It's a live-action cartoon hybrid called Son of Zorn, where Jason Sudeikis is voicing the cartoon character on the show.
And no more Border Town.
No more Border Town. No, exactly. So, and sadly, no more Grindr. So no more Rob Lowe and no more Grandfather, no more Stamos as well.
Okay, this summer, though, we are going to say hello to Maria Bamford in her new show, Lady Dynamite. It premieres Friday on Netflix, and let's listen to a bit from the trailer.
Maybe it's time for me to be less cautious. You think I'm ready to date?
Good, because I've already set you up with someone I know. He's bisexual, but he also has a crippling meth addiction.
Sounds good.
Okay, so that sounds funny. It's a mockumentary about Maria Bamford's life.
Yeah, and it comes from creator Mitch Hurwitz, who also created Arrested Development. So right there, you know you're in for a quirky, different ride. What's interesting about Maria Bamford is she's someone who personally had struggled with mental illness. And mm-hmm. actually, because this show is autobiographical, it kind of touches on that and how she's lived her life in sort of working around her bouts with mental illness. And it looks to be very interesting, very funny, but also very touching and pretty deep as we sort of explore her world and how she sees the world.
And speaking of funny and yet deep and touching on social issues, RuPaul's Drag Race. I mean, you might just say, oh, it's just a bunch of drag queens competing in a reality show. But it actually talks about some pretty serious issues about discrimination.
Absolutely. And RuPaul has done such a great job, you know, having broken down all those barriers in the 80s and 90s. And now RuPaul's been such a great role model for a whole new generation that, is more accepting. And it's been a great show to sort of, you know, I think normalize a lot of things, too. So, yeah, it's absolutely a touching show, but also a lot of fun.
And the finale is tonight. And it's coming back, right, for season 9 in the fall?
Yes, it does. It does very well. So, absolutely.
Okay, great. Well, Michael Schneider, have fun in New York.
Thanks so much. I'll bring you back some.
Okay, good. Bring me back a little piece of the apple. Michael Schneider, host of KCRW's The Spinoff and now the executive editor at IndieWire.
Thanks a lot.
Okay, we want to hear from you. What shows are you sad to see go? Let us know. Call us at 1-844-PRESSPLAY or you can go to our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. Coming up, the story of Mexican-American women being sterilized at L.A. County Hospital.
She was made to feel ashamed by her husband, who thought she did it on purpose. She did that she didn't want to have any more children.
Was it eugenics or a gross misunderstanding? We revisit the film No Más Bebés next on Press Play.
Listen to KCRW's music stream, Eclectic 24, for hand-picked music around the clock. You can find all of KCRW's produced content on our app. Download for free at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. At its simplest, eugenics means deciding who is fit to have children and who is not. And when you use that word, Nazi Germany is usually what comes to mind. But the fact is that the United States practiced eugenics well before the Nazis did. Around the turn of the century, maybe as a reaction to the influx of European immigrants, eugenics was considered a legitimate public policy. And even after the war, those ideas did not disappear completely.
There was shock last month over the revelation that the state of Virginia sterilized thousands of persons between 1922 and 72 in a program aimed at ridding the state of so-called misfits. Now it develops that similar programs were carried out in some 30 states.
Getting rid of so-called misfits may have been behind the sterilizations of 100 women or more at the Los Angeles County General Hospital in the late 1960s and early 70s. These women, mostly poor Latina immigrants, came to the hospital to have babies. And while they were there, doctors made sure they'd never have another child. A documentary tells the story of 10 of these women who sued the hospital in 1975. Oral historian Virginia Espino is the producer of No Más Bebés.
I grew up in Northeast Los Angeles, and my parents are both Angelenos, although my mother arrived in the U.S. when she was 12. The experience of growing up as the other, being treated as the dirty Mexican or the lazy Mexican, it politicized me even before I could put words to that experience. Well, I went back to school after I taught for about 6 years in Boyle Heights. I was an elementary school teacher, and I started taking classes, night classes at Cal State Los Angeles. And that's where I learned about the history of the sterilization of Mexican women at the LA County Hospital.
Before the baby was born, the doctor called a young nurse over and she told me I needed to sign. It was in English, she said. You need to sign right away. They're going to do a C-section. I said, I can't sign. My husband Robert isn't here. If you won't sign, they can't operate. If you don't sign, you'll die. Then the nurse grabbed my hand and signed my name. I didn't know I was sterilized until 4 years later.
I saw doctors hold up the syringe and say, you know, do you want this shot? Do you want this shot?
Karen Banker was a medical student who worked at the hospital.
No mas dolor. This, showing the needle, this will take away the pain. Sign.
It was so hard to believe, and especially because I grew up so close to the L.A. County Hospital, and where I worked, Bridge Street Elementary, it was right in the shadow of the L.A. County Hospital. I found one article that explored this history, but there was nothing else. There was nothing current. So I wrote my first research paper on the sterilization, and I tried to look at it from the perspective of the eugenics movement and how this was part of that same idea of who is fit, quote unquote, you know, to give birth, to have children. There's the belief system of the doctors themselves dealing with a population that they don't really know, they're unfamiliar with.
I arrived in Los Angeles. I had no clue what Hispanic culture, language, mores, anything.
Dr. Jerry Newman was a medical resident at the USC Medical Center.
We met our junior and senior residents. We had approximately an hour orientation, and they said, go.
One thing I picked up this year was a whole new prejudice. I didn't have anything against Mexicans when I came here.
Actually, Dr. Bernard Rosenfeld was the whistleblowing doctor who exposed that these sterilizations were taking place at the hospital.
These are various conversations I did write down when I would talk to other doctors. Most people wouldn't believe it unless they heard it directly, so I went around with a couple of investigative reporters from the LA Times. Another doctor said, Dr. Forster, yeah, all they do is screw, drink, and drive. 59 Chevys with ruffles on the top with baby boots.
And then there are the historic stereotypes of Mexican women as hyperfertile. There are some quotes that don't come through in the film where one of the doctors said they used to come by the busloads to deliver their babies here.
This is the emergency department in Los Angeles County, USC Medical Center. We see approximately...
This is war zone. You call it the war zone.
Dr. Howard Blanchett was a resident at the LA County Hospital.
You'd open the doors to labor and delivery, and there would be women on gurneys laboring in the hallways because we didn't have enough room.
So that gives you a sense of where the doctors were coming from as far as feeling overworked, feeling that the Mexican women aren't being responsible in their birthing practices. Let me do everyone a favor by sterilizing them. That way they won't have any more children and we won't have this influx of constant pregnant women coming in to deliver their children. And then there's the fear of the population bomb that emerges around this period.
Donald Rumsfeld, a White House counselor, said today Washington eventually would have to do something about this country's rapidly growing population. For example, he said it'll have to decide about persuading or coercing its citizens to have fewer children.
And Richard Nixon decided that this was something he thought the federal government should get involved in this idea of controlling the population.
And our cities are going to be choked with people. They're going to be choked with traffic. They're going to be choked with crime.
So he poured huge amounts of money into public hospitals throughout the U.S. for family planning. And sterilization surgery was one of those freebies that you could get from the federal government. But something so positive and so empowering for women turned into something sinister.
In Montgomery, Alabama, two black sisters, Minnie Ralph, 14 years old, and Mary Alice Ralph, 12 years old, were sterilized. They were operated on at a clinic which gets money from the Federal Office of Economic Opportunity.
You had people with these old views, these ideologies about, and I think it even exists today, you can see how people view the Mexican population when it comes to how we practice our or don't practice family planning, you know, how many children we have or we don't have. And that exists today, and it existed back then in the 70s in the minds of some of the doctors who were working at the LA Public Hospital.
If you're just joining me, we're talking about the documentary No Más Bebés. Virginia Espino is the producer of it. It's a documentary about 10 women who sued the LA County Hospital in 1975 for sterilizations they didn't want, and in some cases, didn't even know about. Espino wrote her dissertation on the activists who helped bring the case to trial. She lived and breathed it, but she never actually met the women. As an academic, she was advised that it wouldn't be ethical to seek out the women in the case. Of course, as a documentary filmmaker, those rules don't apply.
Renee Tajima Pena is the director of No Más Bebés, and we met through mutual friends. We wanted to focus on the women who decided to bring suit against the LA County Hospital in 1975 to humanize the fact that when we talk about overpopulation, or when we talk about the abuse of the welfare system, or when we talk about anchor babies and immigration, that there's a human being on the other side of that conversation.
These are three of the 10 women who sued federal and state officials and doctors at County USC Medical Center for violating their constitutional rights to have children.
They went into the hospital to give birth to a child that, while at the hospital in labor, having complications, we are saying that it was not a free, informed, or voluntary consent, and that thereby the civil rights of these women were violated.
From the federal courthouse, Frank Cruz, News Center 4.
The lawsuit is named after Dolores Madrigal. That name just is etched in my brain from the time that I read about the case, and I wanted to meet her very badly, so we started with her.
Not too long ago, Dolores Madrigal considered her life a fairy tale. After living in Los Angeles for 6 years, she rediscovered her childhood sweetheart, Orencio. At age 37, they were married, and even though they had gotten a late start, they both wanted children, at least three. But that's when her life became a nightmare. Mrs. Madrigal says that while she was delivering her second child at Los Angeles County Hospital, she was sterilized against her will.
Maybe it was after about a year of looking for her, going to her old residences, talking to people who knew her, following her tracks from one church to another. We did solicit the help of a private investigator who found that she was living in another state. At that time, she was living in Las Vegas, and we flew out, and I met up with her on a Friday evening at a church event. And there was loud music playing, a band playing, food, and it was a wonderful meeting. Then we went back to her home and, you know, continued our conversation and came back the next day. And it wasn't until we brought in the cameras that she became more apprehensive about her decision. That episode in her life is still very much an open wound. I was definitely nervous about asking her what exactly happened to her, because she was very emotional about it right away when she started talking about how they came to her with the papers and how angry she was and hurt. But I had to ask those questions. They were important questions to ask. We cried together. It was hard not to sit with her and have her tell me these real life stories that I had only read about and not be profoundly moved by the experience. She was made to feel ashamed by her husband, who thought she did it on purpose. She didn't want to have any more children.
That's when he started to drink. He found refuge in alcohol. He'd say women do this to be with other men and their husbands never find out. I said I didn't do that, but he didn't understand it. Then out of nowhere, he'd hit me.
They lost the lawsuit. The court said that there was language and cultural differences and that the women's case was one of a misunderstanding, not necessarily one of abuse. But the practice of approaching women at the time of labor to sign consent forms for sterilization stopped immediately after the public was made aware of what was happening.
The federal government has agreed to provide consent forms in English and Spanish, and the state has agreed to provide bilingual counselors at county hospitals.
Because I grew up with so much racism, and I grew up feeling like my community and my culture was not valued, it hurt at the core. Not so much because of the simple fact of losing your ability to procreate, but the fact that you're losing it because of your heritage, because of your language, because of your culture. That was really painful.
That's Virginia Espino, producer of the documentary No Más Bebés. Dolores Madrigal is now retired and living with her son, Orencio, in the Los Angeles area. Her husband has died. The women lost their case, but legal civil rights actions like these helped create true informed consent in California's hospitals and hospitals across the country. The plaintiffs and the doctors interviewed for the documentary still disagree about what exactly happened at LA County and why. But in the movie, whistleblower Bernard Rosenfeld points out that it wouldn't even occur to a doctor in a private hospital to sterilize a female patient unless it was a dire emergency. You can see No Más Bebés tomorrow morning as part of the Women, Society, and Power series at Santa Monica College. There will be a Q&A after the screening with Virginia Espino. For information about that and other screenings and events, go to our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW. Find all of KCRW's music, storytelling, cultural, and news podcasts on our iTunes page.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. When news that Scarlett Johansson landed the lead role in a live-action remake of Ghost in the Shell, fans in America went bananas. And not in a good way. And that's because the original Ghost in the Shell was manga, you know, Japanese. And ScarJo is white. But many fans in Japan don't see what the big deal is. In a recent article in The Verge, Emily Yoshida explains why the reaction in Japan is so different from the American reaction. And she's here now. Emily, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, first, tell us more about Ghost in the Shell. It was created in 1989. Who's the main character and what's her storyline?
So the main character and the character that Scarlett Johansson will be playing is named Major Motoko Kusanagi, and she's a cyborg character, as are many of the characters in the film. And the film, the original film, the 1995 animated feature film, kind of centers around her not really being quite sure where her consciousness is. It's kind of becoming unmoored a little bit, and eventually linking up with this artificial intelligence to kind of create one stronger artificial intelligence. It's very much in the cyberpunk genre, very much a seminal cyberpunk text, I would say, and also one of the more important anime franchises in the last several decades.
And so the 1995 movie, it was a Japanese movie, and the lead character was a Japanese actress?
Yeah, voiced by a Japanese actress. It was a Japanese language feature-length animated film.
Right. And so along comes Scarlett Johansson, this live-action adaptation of that movie, and people here are kind of angry about that, at least fans are. And so what is their objection?
Well, I think the objection overall, I would say, is more... I would say it's less about Scarlett Johansson being a white actress playing this character who, you know, as I said, is a cyborg, and we can get into the kind of the long history of how characters represent themselves in animated projects. But I think it's a little more kind of seeing the picture of Scarlett Johansson as this character, this very beloved character who's starred in multiple iterations of this franchise, being played by a white actress. It does kind of feel like that a very fundamentally Japanese story is being represented by a white actress in a film directed by a British director. And I think with the, I think one of the screenwriters is worked on Straight Outta Compton. A white guy.
Right. Although when you look at pictures of the character online, she doesn't look Japanese per se. She does look like this amalgam of different cultures, I guess. Or...
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's in my article, that's sort of what I talk about is the history that leads to this. You know, the conception of what we think of as the anime look really starts after World War II, when Japan had to rebuild their economy. And they started with toys, and they started with kind of selling things that would be irresistible and cool, and then eventually cute to mostly Western kids. And so that starts with little tin toy American Jeeps, and then goes on to robots, and goes on to kind of an almost exaggeration of the Disney style that was so popular in the States at the time and still is now. So kind of almost taking what they know works, what they know is popular internationally, and doing it even one better, making the eyes even larger, making the heads even bigger, you know, really getting good at that, making that their key export, their key cultural export.
Yeah, you think of Astro Boy as a prime example of those big eyes and really cute and not Japanese looking, not Japanese eyes.
Yeah. And I mean, now I think anime has become so synonymous with Japan that you see an anime character now and you think, oh, that's Japanese. But the actual look comes from this sort of reflection and self-reflection and a lot of, you know, honestly, like self-erasure of a Japanese face from Japanese culture. I mean, before the war, in commercial art and in cartoons or you know, just the kind of images that an average Japanese person would see day to day, you would see images that look much more Japanese, whereas after the war, you kind of see more of this exaggerated look, more of a Caucasian look.
So self-erasure in order to sell the products overseas for an American audience who were threatened by the Japanese?
Yeah, I mean, it was the Japanese face, the Asian face was still very much associated with untrustworthiness, with sneakiness. You know, there's all, you know, you can see some really horrific World War II era propaganda just doing the very, very exaggerated Japanese caricatures. And that is how, in the Western imagination, that was the Japanese face. And so in order to have something that would be palatable to kids, it kind of had to veer in another direction.
Kids abroad or kids in Japan or both?
Well, both. It ended up, you know, it ended up being just as successful in the States. And it ended up just being something that that Japan embraced, more or less. And I always want to make be sure to kind of emphasize that this isn't done out of deference or even necessarily like, oh, an American face is better, like we're in so in awe of white people. It's really at this stage and that at a very, very key point, really about economics. Like it's about supply and demand. And that ends up being so reflected back within the culture over and over again that just becomes the look. And the irony is just that, you know, now, or like starting in the 80s when anime really started to gain popularity in the States, one of the biggest cultural exports that Japan had was anime and manga, and it didn't have Japanese faces in it. It's a cultural export that does not have the actual image of a Japanese person in it.
So people in Japan are not really upset over this casting of Scarlett Johansson.
No. I mean, I'm kind of, it's hard to find this stuff. I'm not a fluent Japanese speaker or reader, so it's hard for me to find it. But I was looking around and I found this video where this vlogger kind of goes around on the street in Tokyo and is asking young adults what they think of this casting. And most of them are like, well, it's an anime character, so, you know, it wouldn't necessarily look right if it was a Japanese character. And they said that about the Scarlett Johansson character. There's also, he goes on to ask them about another anime character that's getting cast, or that's getting cast for an American remake, a live action remake. And since they already had a live action remake of it in Japan, they're much less open to the idea of an American actor playing that character because they've already seen him as a Japanese actor. So
is there any shift to amongst anime and manga creators to create more Japanese looking characters?
I think you see there's definitely a wide range. I think, you know, people maybe who have only seen a little bit of anime think of one specific idea of what an anime character looks like. But I mean, this includes, you know, the films of Hayao Miyazaki are anime, and that's very, very different from Ghost in the Shell. That's very different from stuff that's more explicitly for kids or kind of more otaku, which is like anime fanboy, you know, like the super exaggerated, like cute girls type stuff. Yeah. That they're all, you know, this all, I always think is kind of different that anime is considered a genre because it's just a medium. And there's so many different ways of presenting human stories, reflecting back current day concerns or not. So I think, you know, you have much more naturalistic looks in the Studio Ghibli films. And there's also a filmmaker who died a few years back, Satoshi Kon, who does much more realistic drawings, realistic character designs. So,
okay. Well, thanks so much for joining us. That was really interesting.
Yeah, of course. Thank you for having me.
That's Emily Yoshida, entertainment editor at The Verge. Julie Myers is here now with listener feedback. Hi there.
Hello. And listeners wanted to share their affordable housing horror stories.
So, of which there are many, I'm sure.
I mean, yes. I would say a dime a dozen, but that might be too expensive. Andrew called in and he says that he lives in Burbank and he makes $14 an hour and he's actually renting a 4x9 closet for $325 a month and that's all he can afford. So that's the city that we are living in, or the region that we're living in there. And Francisco Abrego just cannot believe that $4,000 for a two-bedroom house on the west side, that's what he was looking for and finding. He's like, who can afford that? I can't afford that. There's no way. So if you have a story to share, Facebook, KCRW Press Play.
Okay, thanks so much, Julie Myers. Please hit us up on one or both of those. I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks so much for listening. I'll see you tomorrow.